We look forward to Daniel's consideration of Isaiah 46 and to the theme, "To whom will you liken me?"
Thank you, Samuel, and good evening, everyone. Bell boweth down, Nebo stupid. Those words would have come as a real surprise to Isaiah's listeners, because it's talking about the destruction of Babylon before Babylon had even risen to power to the full extent anyway. At this time, Assyria had been the world's great power until, outside the walls of Jerusalem, their army was decimated, hundreds of thousands of them, and that was really the demise of the Assyrian power. And during that time, Egypt had been Assyria's nearest rival. They'd been the number two. And Babylon during this time was still rising towards prominence in the world. They only surpassed Egypt and became the number one power themselves in a battle called the Battle of Carchemish, which is mentioned for us in Scripture in the final chapters of Jeremiah. And it was a surprise defeat. Babylon defeated the Egyptians at this Battle of Carchemish, and it was only then that they really began their rise to power, becoming the world's most extensive and powerful empire of the time, the first universal empire that the world had known. But while this chapter 46 of Isaiah was being spoken, Babylon wasn't there yet. Babylon wasn't at its peak. It was still rising towards that power. And the people in the kingdom of Judah would have been aware of this. In fact, relations between Judah and the kingdom of Babylon were quite cordial to start with. Come back to Isaiah chapter 39. When Hezekiah was reigning, he'd been sick to death, and miraculously he was cured of that sickness by God. And the Babylonians sent envoys. They sent people as representatives of their king to wish King Hezekiah well because of his recovery. Isaiah 39 verse 1. At that time, Merodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he had heard that he had been sick and was recovered. And Hezekiah was glad of them and showed them the house of his precious things, the silver and the gold and the spices and the precious ointment, etc. But there was these people sent as representatives from the king of Babylon to come and see Hezekiah and bring him a present and bring letters. Babylon and Judah were on friendly terms to start with. Babylon was interested in the affairs of the kingdom of Judah, and likewise, the Judeans would have reciprocated that. They would have been interested in Babylon's affairs, what was going on up there, what their kingdom was like, their cultural ideas and beliefs, etc. So there was knowledge by each other, by these two nations, of the other's kingdom. It was only later that hostilities began to grow and grow between the two nations. What I'm saying is that Judah would have known something, at least, about Babylon's history and culture, the gods that they worshipped. They would have known about these gods, Bel and Nebo, mentioned in Isaiah 46. But it would have been a real surprise to hear that Babylon, to hear Isaiah prophesy that Babylon, its doom was coming. They would bow in submission to Yahweh, the God of Israel. It was surprising because Babylon hadn't even taken Judah captive at this time. You could even say that it didn't look likely that that would happen at this time. Judah was dwelling quite confidently in the land. The Assyrians had gone, that terrible threat. The siege was over. And now they could get on with their life in relative freedom. And so they did. They were confident, arrogant even. Didn't expect an invasion to come from Babylon, and beyond that, didn't expect Babylon to be taken. That fortress city which they'd learned about, all its riches, plenty of gold in that city, the huge fortifications. The walls were so thick that horses pulling a chariot could drive along the walls and have enough room to turn full circle and go back the way they were coming. Amazingly thick fortifications, the like of which hadn't been seen in the world up to this time. Incredible technology in that city too. You may have heard of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. It was the jewel in the crown of the Babylonian Empire, which was growing in strength. And they thought, the Babylonians thought, it was indestructible. And so probably did the rest of the world. And the Babylonians also thought that their success, their increasing success, and their marvelous fortress city, behind all of that were these gods that they served, bringing this success. And Israel would have known something about these gods. It's interesting to consider those two gods mentioned there, Baal and Nebo. What they meant in Babylonian tradition. The first god, Baal, was the most important in Babylonian theology in their pantheon of gods. And he was considered to be lord or master. Nebo was considered to be the prophet. Baal was also known by other names, which you may have heard of. Merodach is mentioned in scripture. His other name, Marduk, isn't, but you may read about it in historical books. Now, in the ideas of Babylon about their gods, Baal was described as the supreme god. He was top dog, so to speak. And he's also described, and this is very interesting, as, we'll come back to this later, the King of Gods and Lord of Lords. Nebo, apparently, so the Babylonians said, to him belonged wisdom and prophecy. Now, these things are important as they have a bearing on the chapter, a bearing on the understanding. Apparently as well, Nebo knew all that there was to know, quite a plan. And during a feast which happened once a year in Babylon, they'd set this god Nebo up in one of the rooms of their temple, and apparently he was to write on the tables of destiny on a stone. Apparently this god would etch writing on there. Of course he couldn't literally do that. Must have been one of their priests that did it for him. But what he wrote would, according to their tradition, come to pass in the following year. So that's why he's known as the prophet. Now, in miniature, Baal and Nebo bow down to one man. I'll explain what I mean if you come to Daniel and chapter 2. This will explain why I've taken some time to write the meanings, the ideas behind these gods up on the board. Daniel chapter 2 is about Nebuchadnezzar's vision, this image that he saw, and that worried him so much. A very significant prophecy because it covered a scope, a large scope of world history. And finally, Daniel came before the king, and the king was amazed when Daniel unfolded to him his dream, which he hadn't told anyone about, and the interpretation of it. So it's Daniel chapter 2 and verse 47. Let's just take 46 to lead into the verse. Then the king Nebuchadnezzar, after Daniel's explained it all, fell upon his face and worshipped Daniel and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odours to him. The king answered unto Daniel and said, Of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldest reveal this secret. See the meanings of those two gods? I should explain, first of all, that Baal was Nebuchadnezzar's favourite god. He worshipped him almost to the exclusion of all other gods. Nebuchadnezzar did. And Nebo, that forms part of his name. You can probably see that. Nebuchadnezzar, so to speak. So they were his two favourite gods. Verse 47, the king answered unto Daniel and said, Of a truth it is that your God is a God of God and a Lord of kings. That's what the Babylonians believed Baal was. And also, and your God is a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldest reveal this secret. That's like the meaning of Nebo. To him belonged wisdom and prophecy. So Nebuchadnezzar's saying, Daniel, this is incredible that you've been able to explain to me the dream that I had and the interpretation of it. And I'm so impressed by this that I admit that your God, Yahweh, replaces both of these gods in one swoop. Both of my gods, Bel and Nebo. Yahweh has outperformed them because he's both of them combined. Can you see what I'm saying there? So, in miniature, and perhaps not completely, was Nebuchadnezzar convinced from this point onward that Yahweh was God? I don't think this finally convinced him. It was just for the moment. But anyway, at this time at least, Nebuchadnezzar, in his mind, in his estimation, Yahweh had replaced Bel and Nebo. Bel and Nebo had bowed down to Yahweh in Nebuchadnezzar's mind. So in miniature, that's a fulfillment of Isaiah 36, verse 1. The real fulfillment comes later in Daniel chapter 5, the end of the kingdom of Babylon. And Daniel chapter 5 is painted as a showdown between the gods, between Babylon's gods and the gods of Israel. Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, his drunken feast with all the lords. Look how Daniel chapter 5 sets this up as a challenge, a combat between whose gods are the strongest, Babylon's or Yahweh? Yahweh, this God who they'd now taken captive his people, Judah. They'd taken all the treasures out of his temple in Jerusalem and they'd brought them to Babylon. And now they were using them in mockery to drink their wine, the vessels of that kingdom, to drink their wine and to mock the God of heaven. So, Daniel chapter 5, verse 1. Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the thousands. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and the silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes and his wives and his concubines might drink therein. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem. And the king and his princes, his wives and his concubines drank in them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold, of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. Great are the gods of Babylon, they were saying. And who's this Yahweh, the God of Israel? We'll just drink our wine and get drunk out of the cups from his temple. But that's not how the chapter finishes. Verse 22 and verse 23 are interesting in regard to our chapter in Isaiah. The hand has come and written upon the wall the words Meni, Meni, Tekel, Upharsin. And Belshazzar has gone from being an arrogant and confident, proud king to trembling and fear and wondering what's going on. And in verse 22, Daniel continues his answer. And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this, but hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought thee, the vessels of his house, before thee. And thou and thy lords, thy wives and thy concubines, have drunk wine in them. And thou hast praised the gods of silver and gold, of brass, iron, wood, and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know. And the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified. So, finally in verse 30, in that night was Belshazzar the king of the Chaldeans slain, and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So much for these gods of Babylon, and so much for Yahweh. He'd overturned them in one night and shown Belshazzar who indeed was Lord. So that was the fulfillment of Isaiah 46 verse 1. Let's just go back to that chapter now. So Isaiah 46 is looking forward in time to the time when Babylon would be stormed, would be invaded by Cyrus, that incredible event. And the gods of Babylon, who were considered to be behind the success and achievement of Babylon, were shown up for what they really were. Yahweh was supreme. It's interesting, if you just look back a few verses to the previous chapter, 45 and verse 23, because there it says, I have sworn by myself, the word is gone out of my mouth in righteousness, and shall not return, that unto me every knee shall bow, every tongue shall swear. So every knee was to bow, including this proud, magnificent city of Babylon, that was to humble itself, or be humble before God. Ultimately, the fulfillment of verse 23 is the kingdom. But first of all, chapter 46 verse 1 had to be achieved. So the bowing down of that verse is linked to the bowing down of verse 23 of the previous chapter. And now the idols of Babylon are in shame. Verse 1 goes on to say, let's start from the beginning. Bel boweth down, Nebo stoopeth. Their idols were upon the beasts, the idols of Babylon, and upon the cattle. Your carriages were heavy loaden. They are a burden to the weary beast. These supposedly all-powerful, all-knowing gods now have to be carried about on the back of cattle, on carts and things. And what's more, they were heavy. That kings would normally travel around on horseback or something magnificent like that, wouldn't they? And now these gods are travelling around on the backs of animals. How humiliating is that picture for them? Verse 2, they stoop, they bow down, answering, boweth down and stoopeth, of verse 1. They could not deliver the burden, but themselves are gone into captivity. Powerful gods, now subject to another power, supposedly powerful gods. Captives, imprisoned, led about by the will of another power. And they could not even deliver the heavy weights that they were causing the animals to bear in the carts. They couldn't even ease the pain of that as they were being carried about the city and out of the city. A question for after, during the discussion period, because verse 1 and 2 didn't happen as it's literally set down there. When Cyrus entered the city, he installed Bel and the other gods, I think, as well. Definitely Bel. He installed them to a position of prominence, first of all. Obviously, after a while, they went to obscurity because Babylon, the city, was razed to the ground. It was just dust. So obviously their gods faded to obscurity eventually. But first of all, they were treated quite respectably by Cyrus. So why is that? Why doesn't the history seem to match up with what we've read in chapter 46, verse 1 and 2? Is it just a picture that's being painted to describe the humiliation of gods rather than being accurate in all of its detail? It's a question for afterwards. Verse 2 is interesting because it says, they stoop, they bow down together. The word together is interesting. Bel and Eva simultaneously bowing down. So the supreme God, the King of God and Lord of Lords, at the same time with the prophet, the one who had wisdom and prophecy, bows down to Israel's God. We're submissive to you. We're lower than you. And it's interesting because that's the issues that this chapter 46 deals with. God's supremacy and also the issue of prophecy. He truly is the prophet, whereas Nebo, he was a joke prophet, wasn't he? He obviously couldn't write on those tables of destiny. I'll show you what I mean. First of all, God's supremacy. Verse 5. To whom will you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we may be like? There is no one to rival God. And verse 9 as well. Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is none else. There's nobody else. I am God and there is none like me. That's God's supremacy, isn't it? That's the first God there, Bel. That's that issue. A prominent theme in this chapter. And also the matter of prophecy. What God speaks comes to pass without fail. It's an amazing thing. Verse 10, for example. I declare the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done. Before events happen, God predicts them, sets them down clearly, and then they happen. Saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure, calling a ravenous bird from the east. That's talking about Cyrus, of course. So those two issues are dealt with in this chapter. They're the prominent ideas of the chapter. Excuse me. So the prophet's having a real go here, isn't he, in chapter 46, verse 1 and 2, showing the inadequacy, the falseness of idols, in contrast to his trueness, his powerfulness. It's just like, in a small way, it's on a lesser scale, it's just like the big picture in Isaiah chapter 44, verse 9. Remember that big section from two classes ago, I think it was. Verse 9 to 20 of Isaiah chapter 44. There was Isaiah ridiculing the worship of idols in that section. And Isaiah 46 verse 1 and 2 is just like that, but on a smaller scale. Now, Isaiah was the first prophet to speak of this captivity and then subsequent destruction of Babylon. He was the first prophet chronologically to speak of the impending destruction of the city. And that's a consistent theme throughout the prophecy of Isaiah. For example, now I've got a list of quotes here showing this theme, so you might want to note them down. First one in Isaiah is chapter 13. First one I could find, I should say, is chapter 13. So we're looking at Isaiah and the way he prophesied the doom of Babylon, that it would be destroyed. And in conjunction with that, of course, that Israel would go into captivity in Babylon And there's lots of verses throughout Isaiah about this. Incredible thing to the ears of the people of Judah. Unbelievable that this magnificent city should fall. To them it seemed unconquerable. Anyway, Isaiah 13 and verse 1. The burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos did see. So it's about Babylon, clearly. And verse 17. Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them. One of the invading powers is even named. I will stir up the Medes against them, which shall not regard silver. And as for gold, they shall not delight in it. Verse 19. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees' excellency, shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. Neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there, neither shall the shepherds make their fold there. Chapter 14, verse 4. Again, it's clearly about Babylon. Thou shalt take up this proverb against the king of Babylon, and say, how hath the oppressor ceased? The golden city ceased. Again, Babylon's doom prophesied. Other verses in the chapter. Verse 12 is a famous verse. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, which is speaking about the king of Babylon, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which did weaken the nations? And in verse 22 and 23 as well. Move on a bit quicker through this list. Chapter 21, verse 9. And behold, here cometh a chariot of men with a couple of horsemen. And he answered and said, Babylon is fallen, and all the graven images of her gods hath he broken into the ground. That's very similar to our chapter in Isaiah 46, the gods being destroyed. Chapter 23 as well, verse 13. Behold, the land of the Chaldeans, this people was not until the Assyrian founded it, for them that dwell in the wilderness. They set up the towers thereof, they raised up the palaces thereof, and he brought it to ruin. Chapter 39. There's many passages, aren't there, throughout Isaiah dealing with this issue. Chapter 39, which we turn to about Hezekiah, when the messengers came to see him after he'd recovered. Verse 6. This is a message to Hezekiah about Babylon. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house and that which thy fathers have laid up in store until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith Yahweh. And of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. So that's the captivity in Babylon, we're told, rather than the destruction of Babylon. Chapter 44, verse 26 to 28. We won't read that, but you'll remember back a few weeks, two classes ago, this was the famous verses about Cyrus and the way in which he was to take the city. Chapter 45, verse 1 to 3, also about Cyrus. And further on into Isaiah, chapter 48, verse 14. All ye, assemble yourselves and hear. Which among them hath declared these things among the nation's gods? Yahweh hath loved him. He will do his pleasure on Babylon, and his arm shall be on the Chaldeans. So there's lots of verses there on this theme of Babylon's destruction. It's a major theme of Isaiah's prophecy, you could say. Babylon and their gods would be destroyed. They would submit, they would bow down, reverence the God of heaven. In contrast to these idols, in Isaiah 46 verse 3, we've now got a section on Yahweh, his qualities, what he is to the house of Israel. Verse 3 of Isaiah 46. Hearken unto me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel, which are born by me from the belly, which are carried from the womb, and even to your old age I am he, and even to hoar hairs I will carry you. I have made, and I will bear, even I will carry, and will deliver you. Did you notice the contrast with the idols of verse 1 and 2? The idols which had to be carried about on carts, on animals. They were very heavy too, a great burden. They had to be carried about. The contrast is that Yahweh carried Israel. He bore them. See verse 3. Which are born by me from the belly, which are carried from the womb. Even to your old age I am he, and even to hoar hairs will I carry you. I have made and I will bear, even I will carry and deliver you. Verse 7, by the way, continues this repeated idea. That's about idols again, verse 7 is. They bear him upon the shoulder, they carry him. So the contrast is quite plain there, isn't it? And there's another word which contrasts as well. At the end of verse 4, even I will carry and will deliver you. He could save them. He was a God that could deliver. Do you remember the idols in verse 2? They could not deliver the burden. Deliver, repeat it again. They couldn't even make the weight of their own persons any lighter for the burden bearers to carry, let alone deliver Babylon, the city, from the invasion. They couldn't do that. So the contrast is drawn out. That little phrase there, was it verse, I have made, I can't put my eye on it, just verse 4. It's the middle of verse 4. I have made, and I will bear, even I will carry you. What does that mean, I have made? It's like the last chapter and verse 11. Thus saith Yahweh, this is chapter 45, verse 11. Thus saith Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel, and his Maker. See the similar language, Maker. Ask me of things to come concerning my sons and concerning the work of my hands, command ye me. He's the one who made Israel. He formed them for a purpose. Verse 12, I have made the earth and created man upon it. I, even my hands, have stretched out the heavens, and all their host have I commanded. I have raised him up in righteousness, and will direct all of his ways. Cyrus. God made Israel. He had a purpose with them. They could be assured of that everything he did was to fulfill this purpose. He didn't just make them and stand back and think, oh, I've made them. I'll just leave them to it, and whatever fate decrees for them, that's what happens to them. He's interested in Israel, whether they are for him or whether they are against him, whether he's punishing them or whether he's lifting them up, whether it's a joyful time. He's made Israel, and that in itself is a declaration that he will continue his purpose with them. They could be assured that he's always with them because he's their maker. And that is what chapter 46, verse 4 is saying. All of this, his care for them, was despite their iniquities at this time. I think this was in the time of King Hezekiah, and there were 7 kings after him of Judah. Only one of them, Josiah, was any good. The other 6, in varying degrees, were terrible kings. Manasseh, for example. We've read about him in the readings very recently. He was a terrible king and led the kingdom of Judah into awful ways, filled the streets of Jerusalem with blood. And that really sums up the mood of the kingdom of Judah. They were wicked people, and despite the occasional good person and the occasional good king who tried to lift them out of their evil, They would not. They'd only reform on the surface. It was never their hearts. You can see this in the expression in verse 12. Hearken unto me, ye stout-hearted, that are far from righteousness. And also in chapter 48 and verse 8, the expression at the end, and was called a transgressor from the womb. So God carried them despite all of that. He still cared for his people despite their iniquities. And he was working with them, trying to get them to turn to him, to love him, to understand. Not to serve their silly idols, but to understand his power. Understand that he was the supreme God. And get them to truly turn their hearts to him and turn from all their foolish ways. Think of the contrast in worshipping this living God to the contrast of serving idols. Idols which are cold and deaf and dumb, unintelligent, not capable of any emotion towards their subjects, the people who worship them, and powerless too. Contrast that with the living God, who's a warm God. He's a living God. He's not just some cold metal statue or something made out of wood. He's not deaf, but he will hear our cries. He will hear our prayers. He's not a dumb idol because he's spoken to us through his word and through his son. He cares about us and he wants us to know about him. He's an intelligent being. He created the universe and knows everything about it. He even knows every single one of our lives, back to front, our joys and our despairs. And he's not cold towards us. He has feelings towards us. He loves us. The idols are capable of emotion, incapable of emotion. And he's also a powerful God who will perform his purpose. And the way he prophesies is one important way to prove this, which the chapter speaks about later. Verse 5, which is the title of our class. Onto the second glass. To whom will you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we may be like? They, that is the Gentiles who worship idols, they lavish gold out of the bag. So they had to get their own gold, first of all, take it out of the bag. They also had to weigh silver in the balance, and then they had to hire a goldsmith to beat it into the shape of an idol, or melt it and cast it into the required shape. And he maketh a god. So they've provided all the ingredients, they've taken it to a man who can fashion it into the likeness of a god, and then they fall down and worship it. It's ridiculous. Verse 7. They bear him upon the shoulder, they carry him and set him in his place. This idol that they've just made, he can't transport himself there, even though he's supposed to be some powerful spirit being that the people worship, some omnipotent being. He can't carry himself to his place of rest. Somebody has to carry him. And there he standeth. From his place shall he not remove. Yea, one shall cry unto him, yet he cannot answer nor save him out of his trouble. It's satire. It's similar again to those verses in Isaiah chapter 44, which ridicule the idea of falling down to an idol. He's appealing to Israel, Isaiah is, to see the stupidity of idol worship and to see the logic of worshipping their God, Yahweh. See the logic that way is. That verse 5, to whom will you liken me and make me equal? Exhortation for us. Well, we just would never say that there was another being in the universe who could rival God's power. We wouldn't say that. But in our actions, I think, well, speaking for myself, first of all, I know there are things in life which I turn my attention to, perhaps giving priority to them and trying to share it with serving the God of truth, to whom give a large portion of time to those activities, besides trying to serve God as well. And I think that's the exhortation for us. Because, like Isaiah 45 verse 23 said, eventually every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that God is the Lord. And those things which we spend our time in life doing, perhaps they will count against us. Perhaps they will be the things that keep us out of that kingdom and ruling with God. Now verse 8 of chapter 46 takes a different turn. Isaiah is asking these people, his listeners, to leave behind the worship of idols and to just think about God, think about his power and what he can do. Verse 8, remember this and show yourselves men. Bring it again to mind, O ye transgressors. Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is none else. I am God and there is none like me. Rotherham has a very good translation of verse 9, and I think it improves the AV. I'll read it out. Rotherham says, remember ye the things named in advance from age past times. Remember ye the things named in advance. That particular phrase seems to make it clearer than remember the former things of old. So God's talking about the way he prophesies and names things in advance, and eventually the listeners can see when they happen. It was all written down in all of its detail, and it's come to pass. Again, this theme of prophecy is prominent in Isaiah. And I've got a list of verses again. Don't think we'll read them all out this time, but we'll take a few. And you can jot the others down and look them up in your leisure. First of all, chapter 41, verse 4. All these verses are in the 40s of Isaiah's chapter, 40-something. So it's an important theme in this particular part of the prophecy. In fact, it's put in juxtaposition against the stupidity of idol worship. So we're looking at verses which show this theme, how that God is able to make a statement, and then that will come to pass in the future. Prophecy, we're looking at verses on that particular theme. So Isaiah 41 verse 4. Who hath wrought and done it, calling the generations from the beginning, I Yahweh the first, and with the last am he. Perhaps verse 21 to 26 makes this a bit clearer. Produce your cause, saith Yahweh. Bring forth your strong reason, saith the King of Jacob. Let them bring them forth and show us what shall happen. Let the idols come forth and show the former things what they be, that we may consider them and know the latter end of them, or declare us things for to come. Come on, tell us things which shall happen in the future, and that will prove the truth and the worth of what you say. Verse 23, show the things that are to come hereafter, that we may know that ye are gods. Yea, do good or do evil, that we may be dismayed and behold it together. And verse 26 as well. Who hath declared from the beginning, that we may know, and before time, that we may say, He is righteous. Yea, there is none. There is none that showeth. Yea, there is none that declareth. Yea, there is none that heareth your words. Chapter 42, verse 9 is another. Chapter 43, verse 9. And chapter 44, verse 7. We can look at that one. Chapter 44, verse 7. And who as I shall call and shall declare it, and set it in order for me, since I appointed the ancient people, and the things that are coming and shall come, let them show unto them. So this idea again, God makes a call, sets history in advance, and it happens. The things that are coming, he shows. Chapter 45, verse 11 to 13, and verse 21 is another one. We've read chapter 46, verse 10 to 11. How about chapter 48, verse 3? I have declared the former things from the beginning, and they went forth out of my mouth, and I showed them. I did them suddenly, and they came to pass. Amazing. It really is amazing. Can you think of anybody else who's done that? Made a statement and then unerringly it comes to pass. Any other religion, do they have that? Also verse 14 and 15. Verse 5 to 8 as well. Verse 5 to 8, let's read that. I have, even from the beginning, declared it to thee. Before it came to pass, I showed it thee, lest thou shouldest say, mine idol hath done them, and my graven image, and my molten image hath commanded them. Verse 14. All ye, assemble yourselves and hear. Which among them hath declared these things? Yahweh hath loved him, he will do his pleasure on Babylon, and his arm shall be on the Chaldeans. I, even I, have spoken. Yea, I have called him Cyrus. I have brought him, and he shall make his way prosperous. So here's a prophecy about Cyrus, which is, again, a feature of this part of Isaiah. Cyrus is mentioned a number of times in different ways. It was an amazing thing that not only the invading power, but also the very man who would lead the captivity of Babylon was named. So this idea of prophecy is the answer, I suppose, to those who would question God's divine control. If he can do this, if he can state a matter and then it happens, I suppose the more time that lies between the statement and the event, the more powerful that makes it. Bear in mind that these prophecies in Isaiah chapter 40, 46, for example, were in the time of Hezekiah, about BC 700, roughly. And when Cyrus actually invaded Babylon, I'm not sure of the exact date, but it's in the BC 500s, I think. Is that right? So, over 100 years in between prophecies of Cyrus being given and when he actually turns up and invades the city of Babylon. Over 100 years between the two things. And it all happened exactly as God had said. By the way, that phrase in verse 9, for I am God and there is none else, that continues the refrain from the previous chapter. Isaiah 45 verse 5, I am the Lord, I am Yahweh, and there is none else. Verse 6 as well at the end. Verse 14, 18, 21, and 22. So it's continuing that statement into chapter 46. Verse 11 of Isaiah 46. I will do all my pleasure, calling a ravenous bird from the east. Have a look at Daniel in chapter 8. The ravenous bird is talking about Cyrus. And Daniel chapter 8 also mentions him being from the east. Daniel chapter 8 is about the ram and the he-goat. And in verse 4, Daniel says, I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, but not eastward. That's because his origin is from the east, and so he can extend his empire northward, westward, and southward, so that no beast might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. And the ram, of course, is talking about the Medo-Persian Empire. So that's an interesting quote to put against verse 11 from the east. Just jot down the other verses which deal with Cyrus. Isaiah chapter 41 verse 2 and verse 25. Isaiah 44 verse 26 to 28. And 45 verse 1. Those were the last two classes. This verse in Isaiah 46 verse 11. And also in 48 verse 15. And there may well be more if you'd like to find them. It's a good idea to keep a list of the various themes in Isaiah and keep adding to those lists. So, verse 12. Hearken unto me, ye stout-hearted, that are far from righteousness. I bring near my righteousness. There was an opportunity. Clearly, it was an opportunity for them. They were a long way from righteousness. They were a long way from pleasing God. But he always held out an opportunity until there was no more need to hold out an opportunity. Very magnanimous, this rebellious nation, and yet God tries time and time again until finally he brought the Babylonians upon them because they wouldn't listen to his prophets. I bring near my righteousness, verse 13. It shall not be far off, and my salvation shall not tarry. And I will place salvation in Zion for Israel, my glory. So that phrase, I bring near my righteousness, is equivalent to, and my salvation shall not tarry. Righteousness and salvation are equated in this verse. In Romans 3, righteousness is attained when he takes away our sins. Let's look at that in Romans chapter 3. It's faith, not the works of the law, the offerings, etc., which accomplished forgiveness. Well, which verse shall we go in? Let's take from verse 20, say. Therefore, by the deeds of the law, there shall no flesh be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. But now, the righteousness of God without the law, outside the law, is manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. So this idea isn't a New Testament idea exclusively. It's also in the law and the prophets, that righteousness is outside of the law. Verse 22, even the righteousness of God, which is by faith of Jesus Christ, unto all and upon all them that believe. There is no difference. And this idea has its origin in the law and the prophets. That's exactly what verse 21 says. And Isaiah is gradually opening out this theme to his listeners. I bring near my righteousness. How? Haven't we been doing all our offerings and going to the temple, like you said, keeping all the feasts? Haven't we been doing all that? And we have the Day of Atonement every year where our sins are forgiven. Doesn't that accomplish righteousness and salvation for us? But it doesn't, because the Day of Atonement keeps coming back year after year. There are more sins to forgive every year. And Isaiah's working towards, he's gradually unfolding until he comes to the crux of the matter in Isaiah chapter 53, the famous chapter about the forgiveness of sins. So those who listen carefully to Isaiah's message would perceive this. They would perceive all these things. Isaiah 53 verse 4, for example. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. And verse 11 as well. He shall see the travail of his soul, and shall be satisfied. By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities. So that's how salvation and righteousness was coming. And for the few in the kingdom of Judah that listened to Isaiah and had humble enough hearts to see the logic of what he was saying, to reject the idol worship that was so prevalent, and to listen to what Isaiah was saying, to serve God humbly, not to be proud and stout-hearted, but to soften their hearts and come to righteousness. And that's the way that Israel in particular will finally bow to God. Every knee shall bow and every tongue shall swear. This is Isaiah 45 verse 23 and 24. Surely shall one say, in Yahweh have I righteousness and strength. It's not our own righteousness. It's in Yahweh have I righteousness and strength. It's that disposition of mind. Even to him shall all men come, including Israel, which is still a rebellious and a nation which is far from God today. And all that are incensed against him shall be ashamed. In Yahweh shall all the seed of Israel be justified and shall glory. Very similar to verse 13 of this chapter. So, one question in particular that I'd perhaps like answered is that question about verse 1 and 2. Why this picture of the idols? Is it a literal picture, or is it just a graphic way of presenting an idea? Because Cyrus didn't immediately remove the idols from their position. He didn't actually carry them into captivity on beasts and carts, etc. So what's the answer to that question? Perhaps we could consider that as one question afterwards. Thank you.